You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always and forever here in my individual capacity. Tonight, we continue our series on scaling AI with a discussion about aligning AI and how our approach to aligning AI may be working against our national security. We're also going to talk a little bit about AI, cybersecurity, defensively and offensively. My guest tonight is someone who actually knows what he's talking about. He's not a policy wonk. He is an actual scientist. You can thank me later, but he's going to talk in a manner that we can all understand because he knows an awful lot of people went to law school because they can't do math. Now, everybody on the other end of this podcast is going, yeah, that's sort of what happened. Anyway, he is actually a PhD. He's a research director at AE Studio, and he's been leading high impact machine learning programs, which he'll refer to as ML. But now you're in the know. So when you hear that, you know, it doesn't mean money laundering, which is what it normally does in the national security space, but it actually means machine learning programs. And he does this at the intersection of research and engineering, and he's established collaborations in AI control with researchers across industry and academia, including some that will be obvious to you: Anthropic, DeepMind, Redwood Research, and Princeton University. And he's developed the world's best brain-computer interface for neural decoding and contributed to open source neural decoding algorithms. I'm saying this for a friend of the cast, Sunita Patel, who is most interested in this topic. And he served as a reviewer at leading machine learning conferences. And I could go on and on, but we're going to stop because he knows enough to explain a few things to us. So anyway, Mike, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
All right, let's do big picture. What the heck is AI alignment and why should we care?
In some sense, it's very simple. It's about getting AI systems to do what we intend for them to do, even if we can't really specify exactly what we intend for them to do. Another word we like to use here sometimes is military grade AI. So we want AI that is robust, reliable, and follows the intention of the operator. And so we should care because this is necessary to win in the AI space as a nation. It's the kind of backbone of what actually drives some of the innovations. So if you look at the history of AI and you look at some of the biggest innovations in recent years, they're actually coming out of alignment. So if we want to win on AI, we absolutely have to win on alignment.
You know, I wonder if we're thinking about that because I'm not seeing the words alignment appearing in a lot of the policy statements. I'm seeing things that appear to me to graft LLM concepts onto other kinds of AI compute concepts. And there seems to be sort of a muddled understanding of this. But I think broadly in Washington and elsewhere, is the fear is sort of twofold. One is that AI will not act as it's supposed to. And we've certainly seen this in the context of LLMs, which I understand is a very different kind of AI from, say, artificial general intelligence, for example. But we're also concerned that it will be susceptible to some sort of penetration or influence or data poisoning that will alter what it is doing. And so it might appear to be acting as it's supposed to on a surface level, but in fact, it's really experienced some sort of sabotage.
Yeah, that's right. So I want to address quickly the first point about not hearing the word alignment. So that doesn't surprise me. The word alignment has been in vogue and out of vogue at different stages of its career, taking different connotations. We're at AE trying to rescue the term and also associate it directly to military grade AI because it's important to get these things right. So that's just the terminology. That's maybe why you haven't heard it. Some people have avoided it for a little bit because of other weird associations they make with it. But then to answer your broader question, yeah, there's all sorts of hazards that come from AI, not just LLMs, not just from AGI. AI systems in general pose a variety of unique risks. AGI, meaning artificial general intelligence, poses its own risk. AI, as we know it today, which is not quite general enough to be general intelligence, but getting there, poses some risks. And other AI systems pose risks. So you mentioned not acting as they're supposed to. That's a risk all AI systems share. They're all built on the same technology stack. So machine learning at its core, ML, as you said in the intro, these systems are vulnerable to being manipulated. And they're also vulnerable to what's called specification gaming, which sounds fancy, but it just means that you get what you ask for and not necessarily what you wanted. So the kind of the King Midas effect, you know, he got exactly what he asked for, but maybe didn't actually want his food to turn to gold, for example. So AI systems, machine learning systems are vulnerable to these types of things. They're also, to talk about hazards associated with these systems, many are dual use and they don't have to be, like I was saying, they don't have to be general intelligence. So there was a AI system trained specifically for drug discovery. This is back in 2001, 2002. Some researchers realized that they could take a constraint, which was the drugs should not be toxic to the user, the human. They realized that instead of having that constraint be they shouldn't be toxic, they flipped it and optimized for toxicity, same kind of model, and they were able to generate 40,000 candidates of potential chemical weapons, including one that was very similar to a known chemical weapon, nerve agent VX. So dual use, that's true for LLMs. It's true for these narrow drug discovery systems. It's true for pretty much most AI systems. They're powerful. So they're a dual use technology. Another hazard is systemic instability. A good example is the flash crash, which happened in 2010, and it was driven by algorithmic trading. So there was some anomalous behavior in the market, and the algorithms responded to that, and then they responded to each other responding to that, and it resulted in this short-lived but very intense crash of the market, which was corrected by invalidating a bunch of those trades. But either way, it was these autonomous systems kind of reacting to each other. And so you can imagine if you have, let's say, autonomous weapon systems set up and some anomalous activity happens, well, this system is designed to react to that activity. And so maybe a missile is launched. And then another system, the adversary system, let's say, is designed to react to that. And then we react. And then you could have maybe a flash war. So if you put a lot of autonomy into a system, it's possible to create instabilities like that. So that's another hazard. A final one maybe to mention quickly, it's a difficult and important problem, is just over-reliance. If you have AI systems that are 99% accurate and you put a human in the loop. So a lot of times you hear with AI systems, oh, we're going to have human oversight, human in the loop. And what happens is you get this rubber stamping effect where, yeah, correct, 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 go, 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 go. And so the human's not actually thinking about it. So they might as well not have a human in the loop. But it extends far beyond even that scenario where, let's say, you needed some research done for some policy decision or something like that. Well, it might be much cheaper for you to ask an AI. An AI, maybe for a dollar and a day, you can get a ton of research done, really thorough and a very high quality report, versus you go and pay a team of people, let's say a month and tens of thousands of dollars for the same quality. And so you have this kind of economic pressure to turn over decision-making, research, drafting, et cetera, over to these AI systems. In that case, you have this over-reliance at a much bigger scale, and that's also worrisome.
I find that especially troubling listening to you, because I think, you know, our audience, a lot of them are lawyers. And one of the concerns that you have with any AI system is, how do we integrate that with our understanding of the Constitution, sort of ab initio, and writing sort of constitutional safeguards into any AI model is just, in my limited knowledge, nearly impossible. I mean, I don't know if it's possible, for example, to train a model to not simply look for indices, for example, through a data set that you could not look for under the Privacy Act if you were doing it yourself. So that's like one scenario. But the second one is, when you talk about a human rubber stamp, there's already a reliance by lawyers on AI. We do a lot of our research on, you know, LexisNexis, Westlaw. We presume the efficacy of that system, one, and two, the reliability of it. And increasingly, we're seeing these hallucinations that appear. You know, that's troubling only because major decisions in Washington affecting human life and liberty are made based on legal research, both into case law existing, policies, executive orders. But it is frightening to think that decisions about sort of the liberty of individuals could be really negatively impacted by sort of a system where people are just agreeing with whatever the AI has pumped out. And I just wonder, as a scientist, have you considered like how you might write against that in terms of algorithmic direction? Because I don't know how the model would anticipate what would come back and require correction, or how to write it not to do things that a human couldn't do in terms of perusing a data set with certain filters.
Yeah, it's an extremely difficult problem. This is why we study alignment. The one lens through which you can view this is thinking about humans have their own bias, right? There's a limited amount of time. As a lawyer without AI, you have a limited amount of time and resources to do your research. And so you're going to surface as much information as you can and scroll through that. So AI might help you there. But then there's a different kind of bias that comes in to what is it selecting as its sources. Forget about hallucinations for a minute, right? You just like, how does it interpret your question and how does it do its research based on that? And then you ask, well, where are its preferences coming from for how it makes those decisions internally? And that's coming back to a handful of people in these frontier labs that are training these systems with. Actually, Anthropic has a training step that they call constitutional AI, and they have their own constitution about how the AI should act. That's more about its personality and what it should and shouldn't do. OpenAI has something similar for how they train and all the frontier labs do. But anyways, the thing that I'm highlighting is actually, I think it's inevitable that we're going to rely on AI to accelerate. It is concerning that life and liberty are in the balance here. It may be a trade-off that we want to make, but you also want to trace it back to its roots of like, what are the trade-offs that AI is making for you? And what we really would like is some sort of robust guarantees about it's generally aligned with your intent for when you're researching or whatever the use case is.
Well, I hope that's true. I just, over a period of time, you know, very often a technology starts and then there are these unforeseen consequences, or once it's out of the gate, it's not susceptible to the kind of manipulation that would bring it into like constitutional alignment, for example, because you really can't adjust it at that point. And that's what it feels like with AI, is that once it's out there, the ability to sort of penetrate these models with something that would cause them to behave in a constitutionally sound way is really a bit of a myth. Let me just pivot for just one second. I want to talk a little bit more about cybersecurity and sort of manipulation, but there now is this sort of popping up of red teams everywhere. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what red teams are, what can they do realistically? And then I also want you to argue against yourself, because we're talking about flat systems, you know, versus these complex ones. Sometimes it's not like you can send pen testing or penetration testing to find the vulnerabilities somewhere in a system. This is an entirely different thing. And I just wonder if you can explain it in the most basic terms to our audience.
Sure. So red teams are designed to catch vulnerabilities or risks in a model, ideally before release, but also sometimes kind of continuously. I'll give you an example of something a red team would do. They do something called an uplift trial. So there's a CBRN, I think is the way, it's a chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear category. So let's say you wanted to test whether or not your model that you're developing helps lay people build a biological weapon. So a red team will do an uplift trial where they say, you take a team of people, half of you will get no model, the other half will get the access to the AI model, and then you try and make progress on building a biological weapon. And the team who doesn't have access to the AI model has access to things like Google or just regular kind of tools. And so what they measure is how much more progress did the team with access to the AI model make than the team that didn't have access to the AI model. That's called an uplift trial. They're seeing how much uplift you get by having access to the AI. So far, the answer is not that much for the models that are being released. But I want to kind of issue a word of caution on that, which is the team sizes are relatively small, small sample sizes. And it's this team or these individuals on the team didn't make much progress. That doesn't mean that if you gave it to a nation state, access to a nation state, and they had access to the model and they had 1,000 people, and, you know, or maybe some of them already had some specialized knowledge that helped it. You know, the uplift trials are meant to catch obvious things. So it's good to do this type of red teaming. There's other types of red teaming that are done, not just biological weapons, but all sorts of behaviors. Can you easily jailbreak a model, which is, you know, can you give it some weird adversarial input to get it to tell you things it would have refused to otherwise? These are useful things, but in reality, red teams can only test a tiny, tiny, basically mathematically 0% of all possible inputs. And so it's great for catching obvious stuff. We should definitely do it, but it's definitely not sufficient to saying a model is safe.
Yeah, I mean, I get people contacting me on this topic since we've been doing this series. And I have to say, some have self-identified as white hats. That's their history anyway. And they seem to understand this stuff, but they're all poo-pooing the idea of red teams as having really any efficacy at all. So I found that interesting. And I thought I would ask somebody who knows a lot more about it than me. But it is alarming too, because in some situations, you know, you can look at other behaviors that are observable, like traffic analysis, for example, could tell you something. I don't understand yet. Maybe you can explain how we can tell with an AI system whether or not it is behaving in a way that would suggest that it's been manipulated in some way, that there has been some sort of activity by like a hostile nation state. What would we be looking for with AI? Because I feel like when you have just normal systems, there are just dead giveaways.
There's a couple of different threats possible here and maybe mitigations for that reason. The case that maybe you're asking about directly is what happens if we have a frontier model hosted by somebody like OpenAI, Google, Anthropic, et cetera. Well, they're hosting the model. They can see all the traffic in and out of their network. And there was actually a case from November of last year where Anthropic announced that they detected and attributed basically a cyber attack enabled by their Claude models. They attributed it to Chinese state actors. They targeted around 30 US institutions, including telecoms, financial institutions, government institutions. They don't in the report say exactly how they determine this, but they do things like they have monitors on top of the traffic to detect, hey, does this seem like the user is trying to launch a cyber attack, for example, right? So they have these classifiers that are trying to classify the ins and outs of the model to understand, you know, how it's being used. So something like that probably triggered internally. And then they did an investigation and determined that there was, in fact, this attack. I actually pulled a quote from that report. So they say, threat actors can now use agentic AI systems to do the work of entire teams of experienced hackers. And threat actors were able to leverage AI to execute 80 to 90% of tactical operations independently at physically impossible request rates. So AI is being used to launch cyber attacks. That's a real example. In that case, Anthropic detected and stopped it. However, the other side of this is, what about open source models? So open source models, you can self-host. They're on your own systems. Nobody's monitoring them. Each individual of those 30 companies that were attacked, for example, they would be responsible for just monitoring their own kind of infrastructure and trying to negate attacks, which the normal kind of cybersecurity landscape, but now you have AI potentially helping accelerate threats against these companies and systems.
Well, that's deeply concerning, of course. Is there a way to integrate sort of hard use catastrophic scenarios into AI development and testing so that they're just designed better from the start to deflect any sort of hijinks by very highly educated, very good state actors who are highly incentivized to achieve some sort of malice?
So we can try. And we do to some extent. So we talked about red teaming and the uplift trials that they do. But there's something fundamental here, which is information itself is often dual use. And so when you put that information in an AI system, that by its very nature can be dual use. And so it's very much a cat and mouse game. You want to surface useful information to legitimate users of the AI systems, but you want to take that same information kind of repackaged in a way that's malicious and block it for bad actors. It's a very difficult proposition, basically. It's a cat and mouse game that isn't solved yet.
Okay. And then I want to jump back for just a second. We're talking about, you know, open models based on open source models versus sort of proprietary closed models. And I'm not sure I'm using the right verbiage there, but I'm not sure our listeners will all know the distinction. And if you could just explain that briefly before we move off to another topic.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So a proprietary model, as you say, is one that the model itself, the algorithm, is behind the company's cloud, behind closed doors. You don't get to see it. You just get to interact with it by, you know, you go to chatgpt.com, for example, and you chat with the AI there. You don't get to see the model itself. You just, it sees your text and you see its text back to you. You could also do that with what's called an API, application programming interface. So you send a message off to the network and you get a message back. You never see the actual algorithm or the model itself. So that's behind closed doors. And for that reason, you always have to connect to Google, let's say, and ask for Gemini responses, and they'll give you responses back, which means Google can see all the requests and data coming in and all the requests and data going out. So they have a monitoring layer. Open source is the exact opposite of that. You have the model, all of its weights, the full algorithm there, and you can just run it on any computer that will run that algorithm. So now you can run it on your laptop or your desktop, or if you want to spin up your own cloud instance, whatever, you have full control over it, which means there's no requests going to other people. So nobody's monitoring what you're doing with the open source models.
All of that makes me exceedingly nervous. Let's talk about how do we integrate AI systems with other systems, because, you know, it feels like you're not going to be able to just overhaul the Pentagon overnight and every single system is functioning in an AI way. There's going to have to be some integration of systems. Typically, what does that end up looking like? And can it actually be accomplished?
You mentioned the Pentagon. One thing to call out here is that last year, Microsoft announced that it's building an air-gapped private cloud for top secret government use, complete with GPT-4. And you mentioned also data poisoning. What is particularly concerning there with this is one type of integration, you could say, where you have this private air-gapped cloud. You could have a GPT-4 model. I'm not saying this is for sure the case, but hypothetically, it's possible that that model has been poisoned, potentially contains sleeper agents. And so you actually put the bad actor inside the air-gapped network, right? So maybe you're not worried about top secret documents getting out of that network, but you might be worried about that model living inside your network and causing some damage there. So something that seems plausible to me is, let's say, for example, Chinese state actors have already, we know there's been plenty of cyber espionage. They kind of understand the format of our top secret documents. And so then they poison GPT-4 in a way that says, if you see a government top secret document, respond in this way. So maybe it's in a pro-China way, or if somebody's searching this document, don't surface this type of information or whatever. And then you put that model in this air gap thing, analysts go in and use that model on their top secret documents, and they're being completely misled, potentially. I want to be clear, this is hypothetical. I'm not saying GPT-4 is compromised, but it's possible. And in fact, there's a study that shows it's quite easy to poison models. So you're talking about integration. So maybe what you would imagine is the safest integration point is this air-gapped environment, but there are still fundamental problems that we haven't solved that don't make that safe. And then you go into other environments and like integrations. We certainly want to leverage AI. AI is an accelerator. I mentioned before kind of the economics of, you might have economic pressure to push you towards using AI more because it's a competitive advantage. That same story plays out at the level of nation states. So we don't want to not use AI, but we have to do it correctly. I would argue that the most correct way is to pay the hard upfront cost of doing all of the research necessary, which is lots and lots and lots of research. We're very, very early in the science of AI and AI alignment, doing all the research to solve some of these fundamental problems, as opposed to trying to patchwork our way to a good solution.
I think a lot of people in the national security space feel like you're building something, so the foundation should be pretty solid and it should be made out of the right material and you should know what the right material is. So, I think that's a view shared widely inside the Beltway with people who are genuinely concerned that everything go right when we integrate these systems in. I know that AE Studio has built a reputation on focusing on the things that get neglected in terms of study. What are some of the areas that you guys have noticed are just being under-researched?
I would say it's easier to point to the things that are being researched, and then pretty much by process of elimination, everything else is neglected. One thing that we do is some neuroscience-inspired approaches. So we work with a neuroscientist at Princeton, and we have some people with neuroscience backgrounds on staff. What we thought was a very neglected approach is maybe potentially on the verge of becoming mainstream. And that's not a bad thing, because if it's promising, then it would be great for more people to do it. And that is around this idea of self-modeling. So if you allow an AI system to understand itself, reflect on itself in some sense, it doesn't have to be, you know, there's no personification necessary here, but just mathematically allow it to kind of understand itself, then you could potentially use that same self-model to model other agents, including humans. This is one theory of how what we do from a neuroscience perspective and forms the basis of cooperation. If you have a model of yourself and you kind of reuse that same circuitry, because that's a very efficient thing to do to model other people, now that forms the basis of how you and I are going to cooperate. We're kind of modeling each other, but through our own self-model. And it also forms the basis of empathy. And the reason I'm saying this is maybe becoming mainstream is because Ilya Stutzkever just recently was on the Dwarkesh podcast talking about this exact same approach and saying how he thinks that this is one of the maybe more promising ways to solve alignment. So I don't know if he's been reading our research or he just stumbled upon the idea separately or what, but it's great to hear that some of the things that were once thought of as neglected maybe would become mainstream. So that's one approach. Another kind of meta thing that we do is we look for really promising researchers who have really big ideas, but they're a little bit too high risk. For example, we work with a researcher who's full-time at Anthropic, and he does his own research there, but he had another idea that would have just been left on the table. And so we decided, hey, that's high risk, but high reward. Let's pick that up and work with him. So he spends 1 hour a week with us approximately, and we put a whole team of work behind that. And so it's a way to take promising but neglected or high-risk ideas and give them some legs instead of letting them just sit on the shelf because there's no other incentive structures for that.
On that score, let me ask you as an AI scientist, what would you want national security policy drafters to understand about AI technology and its development?
I would say the first thing that I would want them to know, and really, I hope this really hits home, is the private sector is not going to build military-grade AI by default. So I'm going to repeat that. The private sector is not going to build military-grade AI by default. They're going to build useful products. They're going to build AIs that act as great employees in corporate America or, you know, help accelerate doctors. Maybe they'll build things that accelerate science, which would be amazing. You know, that might usher in a lot of economic productivity, et cetera. But they're not going to build military-grade AI by default because we're talking about eliminating edge cases and adding robustness layers that just aren't important in the general business and consumer sector, but are extremely important, absolute musts for the kind of national security and for the military. I just want that to be maybe the take-home message that if we want to beat China, who is already investing in military-grade AI heavily, we want to win on the AI front. We have to specifically not just invest in AI. It can't be a blanket statement. We'll invest in AI. There's plenty of private investment in AI that's solving this kind of corporate America, doctor, all that kind of stuff, economic productivity. There isn't nearly enough investment in the core of what's going to get us to what I would call military-grade AI.
You know, there is currently something of a geriatric problem in Congress, and it's not apparent all the time that they're keeping up with technological changes. But I think they would probably be well advised to have scientific advisors who clearly understand this stuff. So I think I have like a side hustle envisioned for you here, Mike.
Well, we do what we can on that front.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in tonight. I think in the future, we'll probably reach out to you again as we sort of get down the road here in a couple of years. But I really appreciate it. And we wish you luck on your research.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
All right. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Please subscribe to NSLT on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. It's not because we just love all these platforms, not true, but it does trigger the algorithm. And guess what? That's how you amplify thoughtful content. There's a lot of noise out there, a lot of political divisions, facts and law. That's what we try to focus on. Remember, our unity is a key feature of our national security. And when we can't agree, we can certainly agree to listen to one another. And part of that is having difficult conversations about trends and forming things as complex as the rapid expansion of AI and the risks ahead. We remain fortunate to live in a country with greater diversity of thought than any other, believe it or not. And that's a good thing, as long as we remain willing to engage in critical thinking. The writer, producer, and host of NSLT is Mia Lisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the lovely, ever lovely Holly McMahon. Our program manager is Antasia Hawkins-Blakeney. Social media and research support comes from Alana Coopersmith. And we are forever grateful to the brilliant minds of the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security who always pursue the good in the interest of national security without regard for politics or party. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.